and cultural needs of the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world.
For more information, go to kboo.fm/45rpm2013.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on your community-run, democratically operated radio station, KBOO. I'm Joe Clement, your host. The Old Mole is a think tank of sorts. It's an audio magazine of views and perspectives and reviews and arguments from an anarcho-syndicalist, commie-pinko, socialist, feminist point of view. On today's show, we're going to hear four different two-part or interview discussion pieces. The first is going to be Bill Resnick talking with Bill Smaldone, a professor down at Willamette University, about the global security state and its relationship to the United States' own national militarization, the increasing militarization that we see across the United States and how that's reflected in the world. Jan Hocken will be talking with Mike Snedeker. They do a interview discussion format that we call the Left and the Law, and they'll be discussing and kind of following up on the outcomes and impact of the California hunger strikes, or the hunger strikes in the Californian prisoners. After that, I will be joined by a local KBOO listener and science fiction aficionado, just goes by the name of Dave for privacy purposes, but we'll be discussing the Union episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and trying to give you a context so you could actually go back and watch it and appreciate its themes on labor. And then to wrap up the show, our movie moles, Denise and Jan Hocken, will be talking about Hope Springs, which is a new Tommy Lee Jones, Meryl Streep movie. They'll be talking about the way that it portrays aging and sexism and storytelling in film. Up now, though, we go straight to Bill's. To now turn to this promised review of...
Anyway, Bill, thanks a lot for talking to us. Hi, Bill Smaldone. Welcome to KBOO again.
Hello, Bill.
Bill Smaldone chairs Latin American Studies at Willamette University, various other things. He just published a history of socialism from the French Revolution till today. It's meant for students, and aren't we all students? His specialty is Germany and the German left before Hitler and after. Over the years, he has served as an outspoken progressive on the Salem City Council, also still chairs his neighborhood association, and has recently worked with others to establish a Salem radio station, much like KBOO. And in his spare time, he reads a lot on international politics. Today, we'll be doing an Old Mole discussion, not so much an interview, but a mutual exploration of the enormous growth and ambitions of the U.S. security state, both national and international, including all the surveillance and intelligence operations, intelligence in quotes, here and around the world, and all of the agencies. They're too long to list, including the CIA and all the police and contracted people and security people in schools. There's an immense security apparatus in the United States. The expansion of prisons and imprisonment, it's just enormous and growing, including volunteer militias that sheriffs are setting up around the country. I could go on with this for quite a while. Bill Smaldone, tell us about the U.S. national security around the globe. It's enormous size, scope, and ambitions.
We've known a lot for a long time. Chalmers Johnson, for example, published a wonderful three-volume study about the extent of the American military-industrial complex and the national security state about 10 years ago, and revealed once again how pervasive American power is all around the world. And this is the power that we tend to see. I mean, he talked a lot about the fact that we had between 700 and 900 military bases scattered around the world with all kinds of firepower available, hard and soft power available to bring to bear at any particular moment. And most of us have known this, but we're being reminded of this with the explosion of information about the surveillance operations that are now being undertaken by agencies like the National Security Agency, the NSA. And there's a terrific piece recently by Tom Englehart, which reminds us of a lot of the things that Chalmers Johnson was talking about on Tom's Dispatch, in which he talks about the enormous size of the American security apparatus and talks about how we are able to project tremendous military power around the world at any moment. And that the costs of this are, despite all the talk about sequestration and cuts to the military and so on, the costs of this are actually far larger than anybody really understands and are approaching close to $1 trillion a year. So we have become this incredibly security-obsessed national security state in which we now have not only hundreds of thousands of men and women in uniform stationed all around the world to project American power, but we also have an enormous and growing security apparatus, some in uniform that we see, like the Border Patrol people and people who are in the Homeland Security apparatus. And then we have this enormous and growing bureaucratic system of spying, these spying agencies, which employ tens of thousands of people and consume billions and billions of dollars, some of which we can't really identify because it's so secret.
That's here and around the world, the surveillance is going on. Let's stick to the international stuff right now and some of the other incredibly dramatic and important powers that the U.S. is now asserting,
right,
and very aggressively, like the drone strikes,
well,
claiming
we're
the right to kill people anywhere on Earth.
Firing drones at a lot of different targets all around the world, many of them in countries that are sovereign states. Well, they're all sovereign states, at least claim to be. We have essentially set aside the national sovereignty of others and decided to assert our power really at will. Now, that's really not new. I mean, the United States has for a long time not respected the sovereignty of other states, or we have talked about or claimed to respect the sovereignty of other states while simultaneously undermining the sovereignty of other states. But now we are much less concerned with making claims about other people's sovereignty, and we have passed laws, many of which are associated with acts like the Patriot Act, that allow us to intervene abroad and claim that this is legal on the basis solely of American law and not international law. And so we can target supposed terrorists or alleged terrorists in places like Yemen or Somalia or kidnap people in Libya. We can take out supposed enemies in parts of Pakistan and claim that this is all legal because our own Congress has signed off on it, usually with very little opposition, and ignore the actual rules that are supposed to govern the international realm.
Bill, tell us about Germany now and the surveillance of Angela Merkel's private phone and others,
yeah,
everybody's private phone. It's a big kerfuffle, it seems to me, on the international front. I don't think it means very much. Why don't you tell us, though?
Well, it's a fascinating thing. And as most people know, Angela Merkel is the chancellor of Germany, which is the most powerful economic state, at any rate, in Europe, and a very close American ally. We often talk about the Atlantic Partnership, and we view Germany as one of our key partners. We don't have a special relationship with Germany like we do with the British, but we have a close relationship with Germany. And now it's been revealed that for 10 years, so even before she became chancellor, we have been listening to her or gathering data about her private telephone calls, not only on her official phone, but on her private cell phone. There are some estimates that we've listened to 500 million German telephone calls, you know, in recent years. This has the Germans really up in arms. And now there's the vice president of the German parliament has called for an investigation and wants to press charges. It's not clear who she would press charges against. or who they would press charges against. But this is important enough so that on November 18th, the German parliament is going to have a special meeting to talk about how to respond to American spying on one of their best parts.
All of this is sort of symbolic and a big show, but Germany is completely dependent on the U.S. for police operations around the globe. Germany is one of the great imperialist powers now with sort of the modern form of imperialism. You don't have to have colonies. You just sort of run the world economy to take things from everybody. It seems to me that the Germans are not going to break from the United States. This is just sort of their sort of anger at U.S. hubris and arrogance that they could think they could get away with this is so bizarre. Yes. But in fact, it means nothing. The people who are doing it are going to continue to do something like it with some sorts of apologies in the future.
Right. Well, you see this in the German discourse every morning when you read the newspaper. Right now, they are talking about this upcoming meeting in which the parliament is going to talk about the American spying operation. At the same time that people express their outrage, you have leaders of parliament, such as the leader of the Social Democratic delegation, whose name is Steinmeier, has said, we don't want to get carried away here. We don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, in our relations with our ally, the United States. So we have to be careful about how far we take this. It's very interesting to watch because the Germans are very sensitive about this kind of activity. Remember, it wasn't long ago that you had all these revelations about the East German spying apparatus and how in East Germany you had a population of 16 million people, and there were 6 million dossiers on East German citizens in the files of the security apparatus. Now, the West Germans were very critical of that. Of course, they had their own spying apparatus, but that was at least under some parliamentary oversight compared to the East Germans. But you still had a great deal of concern in a society in which spying was sort of at the heart of life for a good part of the population. And now to have the ally, right, the leader of the free world, spying on the Germans is quite something. So the German politicians are going to have to make some hay about this. Now, they're probably not going to want to go too far, as you say, because we have joint interests around the world that we will want to move forward on. For example, nobody, I think, among the ruling elites want to throw out the upcoming negotiations about free trade between Europe and the United States. At the same time, they're going to have to do something to make a show for their populations that they're asserting German sovereignty. And it'll be interesting to see where they draw the line.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to Bill Smaldone, who teaches history and administers and works on local politics and studies international affairs in Salem and Willamette University and writes books. Bill, there's going to be challenges to the U.S. We can't really talk about it, but to be able to run drones and to do all their surveillance, they have to run space. They can't be challenged in space. And the U.S., of course, is now unchallenged in space, but the Chinese and the Russians are clearly feeling humiliated, and so is the rest of the world, actually, and are going to do something about it. That's clearly one of the great sort of armed struggles that we're going to see in the future, or potentially military struggles in the future. If you think it's really growing around the world, but both the arrogance and the size, just look at the United States now, where, in fact, the security services are now have entered the schools and the public schools nearly everywhere with their zero-tolerance policies, mostly, of course, directed at urban schools and poor kids, many of them winding up in the justice system and then to fill our expanding jails, although they've slowed down expansion of the jails now because the state is running out of money. The American people are not sold on moving towards complete authoritarianism, which is possible in the future as crises keep occurring, and this enormous expanded security state begins really to feel its oats and decides, in fact, that they really should be running the country one way or another. And they're gaining power all the time. But it seems to me we have to think about how do we stop this whole development.
Right.
And it does seem to me it's possible. Why don't you give us some ideas?
I think that we have a generation of young people now that are really interested in effecting change. I think they are alienated from our political system, and they are cynical about how our political parties function and the way our government is functioning these days. However, they're not cynical about wanting to make the world a better place, and they're willing often to organize to do that. And, you know, you can think about environmental issues, you can think about issues, for example, related to women's rights to abortion, these kinds of things. Young people are prepared and ready to get engaged in on those issues. And I think that as they come to realize that they are really not free to move ahead on the things that they have close to their hearts without this incredible apparatus of oppression bearing down on them, I think they will react to it. And I think it's our generation's job. Our generation, remember, has experienced things like COINTELPRO. It's our generation's job to help educate this new generation about the dangers of the national security state and about the mistakes that were made by us in the past in our dealings with the national security state and about our successes in dealing with that state, and to help them organize. An organization of all kinds of forces is the only way that we're going to affect any kind of change and try to rein this thing in. It's really hard. It's really hard. And we that doesn't mean, by the way, in my view, that you ignore completely the current political structures of our society. But what you have to do is you have to make young people understand that they have to support those courageous politicians who do stand up against the national security state. And one of the people I want to just mention is somebody like Barbara Lee from California. When the Patriot Act was passed, when a lot of this really bad security apparatus, when this legislation came forward, she was one of the only people who got up in the House of Representatives and said no. Right? Feinstein was the senator who did the same thing from Wisconsin. He did the same thing in regard to the Patriot Act in the Senate. Those people have to be supported by us. We have to organize behind them and show them that we're willing to support them. But we also have to organize outside of the sort of the parliamentary realm.
You know, I have a few notes on what can be done as well. Work to preserve civil liberties. There's a whole lot of organizations and people struggling. It's not only young people. There's lots of older people. And in fact, there's sort of a spirit of individual rights and freedoms in the United States that I think are being violated, and you see critique coming from everywhere. It's not as if we're alone.
Right.
And then we also have to just provide a different vision of what it means now. What are the real threats to our welfare in the world now, which is not terrorism, it's global warming and so many other things, economic collapse,
right.
And which in fact contributes to the quite small terrorist threat. And then there's sort of this is the battle for civil rights and humane, effective forms of cooperation and discipline that are, like in the schools, not based on fear and coercion. There are many, many struggles going on. There's lots of allies. Anyway, Bill, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Well, thank you for having me on, Bill.
So long.
Bye-bye.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, brainwash minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
How about a little Sabbath for your morning? That was from their Paranoid album, War Pigs. You were listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. We just heard Bill Smaldone and Bill Resnick talking about the global national security state. There's really kind of a blur of boundaries there. Up next, we are going to be turning to our left in the law moles, Mike Snedeker and Jan Hocken. They'll be talking about the recently ended hunger strikes in California that were in protest of solitary confinement conditions that even the UN wants to designate as torture. Jan and Mike.
On July 8, 2013, more than 30,000 California prisoners initiated a historic hunger strike, calling on the governor and the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to meet their five core demands. 60 days later, and after one death, the strikers suspended the strike. We've been following the hunger strike and the political organizing around what, by some measures, was a successful campaign, and by others, perhaps discouraging. On our Left in the Law segment, Mike, give us an update. What was won, and what remains, and what organizing is going on now, and then perhaps we can turn to the role of families of prisoners in organizing around prison reform?
Jen, I think it has to be considered a huge success because they were coming from worse than nowhere. They were coming from the bowels, the belly of the beast, and without any attention whatsoever. And they succeeded in getting attention from Al Jazeera, from The Guardian in England, from the New York Times, and of course all California media. It's been covered all over the world, and the notion of locking somebody up in a room the size of a ping pong table and never letting them out, the ways in which that is torturous have been discussed in ways they have never been discussed. So what were the actual terms of the suspension of the strike? They are, to some extent, being followed through on, and of course it's up in the air. It requires continuous agitation, organizing, and press releases and the sort of political activity necessary to sustain anything. But I think it bears out the fact that hunger strikes are amazingly effective.
Tell us a little about the history of that as a tactic versus more direct uprisings.
Well, the first really dramatic one in the modern era was Bobby Sands. Bobby Sands in Northern Ireland went on a hunger strike and died after 66 days.
That was in the early 80s.
That was 1981. Along the way, he got elected to Parliament. He became a rock star to the extent that's possible in that he embodied all the desires of everyone in Ireland to throw off the British, even in the United States. Even really hippie-hating Irish congressmen were moved and gave money, and the IRA was propelled forward in a way that it had never been never achieved broad recognition before. I mean, Bonnie Sauter in Iran and Paris, there were, you know, riots around the British embassy in Latin America, all over the world. People were moved by this guy, this cheery-looking guy, the photographs of him as a very amiable, long-haired, soccer-playing, friendly dude who went all the way out.
Now, is there something important, too, about the... I'm a psychologist, so I'm interested in, always in the psychological dimensions of politics, resistance, and struggle. And it seems like this is... Clearly, it's a nonviolent mode of resistance. It's using one of the tools you have, the only, when you're stripped of so much, which is the refusal of food, kind of the control over your body, and refusing symbolically to take in this toxic environment as a kind of... You know, in a way, a desperate act of refusal. What do you think is evoked in this? That is there any way you understand it as a political strategy on that level?
I think you phrased it well. It is a refusal to take in a toxic environment. That's why, like, the Department of Corrections went to and got a court order allowing them to force feed people, even those who had signed a do not resuscitate form.
And that this is even by psychologists recognized as a violent imposition of control on a person, even though it sounds humane, it is quite the opposite. And it's a violent act and extremely painful to force a tube down someone's throat against their will.
Well, what's happened is that there's just a phenomenally large number of people who are engaged in the strike and who are in solitary confinement in California. And it's always been used to isolate people who are like, will kill anybody that they're put in the cell with. You know, the people like that do occasionally exist. There's one in Oregon right now. Or the people who are leading, say, major narco businesses within the prison. But what's happened is a large-scale fan-out of the numbers of people they put in. And the way you can get into solitary confinement now does not require you to misbehave. It only requires you to know someone who's been validated as a gang member. Having lunch with a gang member can have you administratively confined for an indefinite period, for many years. Whereas if you assault a guard, there's like a limited period of punitive time imposed on you. But if it's for the, quote, good of the institution in general, then they'll keep you locked up forever. But one thing that's happened is, with the huge numbers of people, there are as many people in solitary confinement in California as there are in prison in Oregon, in all prisons in Oregon. That means that there's a lot of family members. who have become active.
I'd like to also read from one set of the demands that are perhaps less obvious as violent forms of control, or Michel Foucault would call biopower, you know, kind of controlling the body as the site of discipline in subtle ways. And these are subtle forms of power that are, I think, reflect a lot about the loss of connection to family and community, as well as kind of a denial and degradation of your personhood. These are demands around allow one photo per year, allow a weekly phone call, allow two annual packages per year, a 30-pound package based on item weight and not packaging and box weight, expand visiting regarding amount of time and adding one day per week, allow sweatsuits and watch caps, allow wall calendars, install pull-up dip bars on HSU yards, allow correspondence courses that require proctored exams. I mean, these are, each one kind of evokes a scene, a world. I'm thinking of Irving Goffman's work on asylums, where he was such a careful observer of kind of the daily life of inmates in a state asylum, and how everyone shared one cigarette in a group. You know, these small things that mean a lot and reveal a lot about forms of control. How have some of those basic living conditions and activities of daily living changed over time and become a site of organizing?
Well, they always change. They change arbitrarily and capriciously for no good reason or for very good reasons, but that's what institutions do, is they will switch around. You'll have a privilege you've become accustomed to, and it's suddenly gone. Then out of the blue, there'll be a new privilege. Suddenly you're allowed. But there has been progress made on these peripheral issues, the peripheral to the central core issue of why are people locked up in the first place in solitary confinement. But the family members have been active in the legislature. They've been active in all the conventional political fora. One of the terms, which has been complied with for quitting the strike, were extended hearings with family members testifying, with ex-convicts testifying, with academic experts appearing before the legislature, talking about how extraordinary it is in California and how many other states have gradually minimized and almost eliminated solitary confinement, whereas in California it's such a mass product of the incarceration system. And all that has come out because of family members organizing, and I believe around conditions of confinement, these quality of life issues, they've been concrete gains about the amount of when you can see someone, what you can have in your cell.
At the same time, conjugal visits are a thing of the past. There are six states now that allow for a limited number of prisoners what's called extended family visits. Oregon isn't one of those states, and that's also another site of struggles, how these contacts and just basic human contact beyond the restricted six-second kiss that's authorized by the prisons are allowed. But I think on a larger level, too, it raises the issue of how much can we humanize or reform prisons versus needing to dismantle them. And, of course, there's always a tension around reform versus transformation. But that's an issue I think we'll continue to follow as we follow this particular prison hunger strike in California. For more information on ongoing organizing events, there's some great websites. Global Women's Strike has some wonderful statements and has been active in supporting the strikers and mobilization around the hunger strike. There's a website called it's called Prison. Where is it? Prison Cut. Hunger. Prison. I have to say it before time is up. It may take me a minute. Prison Hunger Strike Solidarity. is the name of the website, Prison Hunger Strike Solidarity. They have a wonderful list of resources, events coming up, and how you can connect and with others involved in the issue. So we'll continue as with this very promising movement. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker with The Left and the Law here on KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. That's Black Sabbath's song, Wizard. I think the Old Mole is a bit of a wizard-like figure. It digs and burrows, and it certainly talks, but we're spreading some magic, some anarcho-syndicalist, commie-socialist, feminist magic. Up next, I will be talking with Dave Fleege about Star Trek. Now turn to this promised review of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine is the third Star Trek that first aired in the early to mid-90s, and it takes place on a space station, and it is a bit more of an experimental format for the show because it doesn't take place on a ship. The episode I'd like to talk about today is called Bar Association. It's listed as episode 16 of season 4, though if you go looking for it on Netflix, it'll show up as season 15 and for some reason be labeled Bar Associate. And I'm joined here by Dave, a local labor activist, KBOO listener, and...
Nerd extraordinaire.
Nerd extraordinaire. To talk to you about this episode because it involves a number of really interesting things. It involves unions, on the one hand. I have called this the union episode of Star Trek. I don't know of any other episode that actually deals with labor in these explicit terms. We wanted to give you enough context that you might go and watch the episode. If not, tune into the whole show, which is really interesting for the way it deals with identity politics. But Dave, I was wondering whether you could lay out some of the main plot points for this episode, specific to the story we want to focus on.
Okay. Essentially in the story, what happens is it starts off with at this space station, there is a bar, and the bar is run by a Ferengi, which is a type of alien in the Star Trek universe. They're very concerned with profit.
And commerce.
And commerce in general. Yeah, there's a lot of dimensions to them. But essentially, the main tension in the episode rests between the owner of the bar named Quark, played by Armin Sherman.
Yeah, Armin Sherman, who was also the principal in Buffy.
The tension exists between him and his younger brother, Rom, who works at the bar with him and is kind of his subservient little brother. And Rom is the employee of Quark. And it leads to a labor conflict, which is very interesting in Star Trek, which is notorious for skirting issues like labor by kind of figuring them out through the mechanics of science fiction. Like there's no need for money in the Federation, which is what you're most familiar with Star Trek. That's one reason why I like Deep Space Nine so much is because it's like a laboratory almost. They can do a lot with it, not only because it's science fiction, but because within the science fiction world that it inhabits – you can just do more. There's more races. There's more diversity on this iteration of Star Trek than there ever were in any of the other ones.
Yeah, so the Ferengi are notorious for essentially being these capitalist avatars. I don't think that Roddenberry actually came up with them himself. They go back to the Next Generation where they show up at least a few times. They're grotesque and misogynistic and chauvinist. And they're also trollish looking, and they have these very pronounced ears, which apparently are, you know, erogenous zones, and they, being these large body parts, have complicated health needs. And Rom one day gets an infection that he got because he didn't have time with all the work that he was doing to actually go get his regular checkup. And even when he does come to work sick and collapses, his brother, aka his boss in that situation, just says, hey, I'm going to dock him his pay for what he broke. But this instigates a conversation with the ship's doctor named Bashir, who, you know, suggests that he should start a union. You know,
yeah, he very much just kind of as an aside brings it up, not thinking of the consequences of talking to Rom about what he should do, which plays out later on in the episode.
In a somewhat simplistic manner, Rom gathers his fellow workers, and there are a number of people for this small place, and says, we should start a union.
Wouldn't you like to take a paid vacation?
You're being ridiculous.
Answer the question.
It's not gonna happen.
It won't happen unless you make it happen. We're Ferengi. And when a Ferengi sees an opportunity, what does he do?
He seizes it?
That's right. And I, for one, intend to grab it. We've been exploited long enough. It's time to be strong. Take control of our lives. Our dignity and our profits.
Yes. Yeah.
Strike a blow against Quark.
Yes.
Strike a blow against the FCA. Yeah. Strike a blow against exploitation.
Yeah.
Are you with me?
Yeah, this is a really, really great example of agitation in the workplace and kind of how localized unions are formed within a workplace. People start to come together, talk about their issues, and realize that they're not alone. And so that's essentially what a union is. It's the recognition of the fact that we're not alone and we're all in the same boat, so we all have the same interest in that regard.
The funny thing about a union being organized in a Ferengi shop, though, is that the Ferengi are just so viscerally against unions and really kind of against the idea almost of escaping exploitation at all.
What you people need is a union. You know, a trade guild, a collective bargaining association, a union. Something to keep you from being exploited.
You don't understand. Ferengi workers don't want to stop the exploitation. We want to find a way to become the exploiters.
Yeah, it's very much the American mentality of wanting to be the exploiter rather than the exploited, and not recognizing that maybe exploitation shouldn't be happening in the first place.
Well, yeah, Rom, you know, speaks out against exploitation, but also speaks for profits. And this is like kind of the central contradiction of capitalism in a lot of ways, but also of the labor movement.
Yeah, it's kind of been slowly imploding over the years because of that type of mentality where people are organizing individuals rather than organizing kind of as a class.
So what happens after they decide to form this union and present their demands to Quark?
Quark essentially just laughs in their faces, which I've personally seen bosses do when the workers kind of present their demands. They basically march on the boss, demanding certain things like paid time off and other things like that.
And they go on strike.
Yeah, and they essentially realize their strength is in crippling the commerce of Quark's bar.
Yeah, they form a picket line and they block access to one of the entrances, but per some agreement, which doesn't really come up until later, they were allowing access to another one so that station security wouldn't crack down on them.
Yeah, which is kind of funny because Odo, the head security officer who's charge of, you know, keeping order on the promenade where the bar is, he has this conversation with Quark, and when they basically, it's like the boss class meeting with the police officers, and even Odo says, you know, if you have to mob up to get whatever you want, it's not worth getting, which is, again, kind of a reinforcement of that American mentality that if you have to demand what you need, a need, that's somehow wrong.
Well, I hate to admit this, but I agree with you. From what Chief O'Brien tells me about strikes, they sound like trouble. I don't like mobs. In my opinion, if you need one to get what you want, it's not worth getting.
And even though Quark doesn't give in to their demands and, you know, tries to get by on holographic waiters, the Ferengi Commerce Authority eventually shows up wanting to put an end to the strike for them. And this, you know, becomes another fold in this vision of labor struggle. And, you know, it's kind of not clear whether the FCA is a state entity, or really, as it kind of seems to me, to be like the parent corporation swooping down in on a franchise where the franchise owner, which will often, you know, be a self-professed like independent business person, is tarnishing the brand by not dealing with this strike.
Exactly. Like it's an affront to all Ferengi that this one owner can't keep his workers in line, which is very much what large corporations do when labor disputes happens. They always send somebody down from up top to try and solve it as quickly as possible without it kind of getting out to the press.
Yeah, and basically what it comes down to eventually is them threatening violence, which is what workers have always faced for trying to organize. But this is not before Quark tries to bribe Rom.
And that bribe is very, very classic of kind of union-busting techniques. It's usually the first one is the extension of privileges to whoever they think is causing the issue. In this case, it would be the extension of money, extra money to Rom in order to call off the strike and dissolve the union. But of course, it doesn't work because he's currently in that scene reading all sorts of things about labor and money and trying to kind of self-educate him on what a struggle means and how to go about it.
Rom, can we talk about this?
There's only one thing I have to say to you. Workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains.
What's happened to you?
And this brings us, I think, to the real tragedy of the episode, which is that the union folds. And I was wondering if you could explain a bit about the tension between the contract and the union in this episode and in the labor movement in general.
I think in this episode, it was a way for Star Trek writers to talk about kind of collective bargaining and maybe some of the pitfalls of it. Because in the episode, Quark and his brother eventually come to a resolution. And part of the terms of that resolution is the union dissolves itself, at least on paper. And that creates kind of a tension and a question at the end of the episode as well. Like, well, what happens once you don't work under a contract? Or if you do work under a contract, especially under somebody like a Ferengi, much like in our society, our capitalist society, it's a way to walk backwards.
I mean, the episode has that early scene where Rom is quoting, you know, the very exact terms of their labor contract. You know, working under a contract doesn't necessarily actually mean, you know, good working conditions or autonomy or respect.
And also from the way he describes the labor contract that he has, it sounds very, very long, like a very long contract. And I don't know about you, but every time I see a long contract, I'm wondering, well, where's the bad part in it? Because they're clearly trying to obscure it with a lot of words.
But that's not all. Quark doesn't just come to this of his own accord.
Yeah, he's definitely pressured by Commander Sisko, who's the Federation officer in charge of running of the space station. And he kind of points out to Quark that they don't charge him rent. They've kind of built up this infrastructure that he profits off of. And so therefore, he should come to terms with his employees, which is very much kind of mirroring the nature of American labor and how that's negotiated, where the state, under the guidelines of the National Labor Relations Board, is essentially doing what Sisko does in the episode. He's forcing the boss back to the table. But sadly, that doesn't actually change the power relations at work. Even after it's resolved, it seems things just kind of go back to the way they were. And, you know, it is TV, so they're kind of limited in their exposition of it. That's essentially the kind of the state coming down and forcing the boss back to the table, even when he really doesn't want to be back at the table.
In the end, they get their demand, so we're told. It doesn't ever really come up in the show again, this dispute and whether it's been honored or not. But it's supposed to end with us feeling like everyone got the most that they could hope to get.
Exactly, yeah. And it's really interesting to see how that all plays out, especially because it's so perfectly American. The episode is so tailored to American understandings of labor, and I think that's why it's really, really valuable.
Well, that's all the time that we have for today. I'm Joe Clement, and I've been talking with Dave, a local Star Trek and labor enthusiast, about the Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode called Bar Association, which raises the question of unions. You can find Star Trek Deep Space Nine on Netflix or at your local county library. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Coming up later this morning on KBOO at 11, on Health Watch, host David Naiman interviews local author Douglas Block about his book Healing from Depression, 12 Weeks to a Better Mood, a 12-week program that combines his inspirational story and practical strategies to everyone who suffers from depression. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, host Will Hall discusses the psychology of power with David Bedrick, counselor, educator, attorney, and author of Talking Back to Dr. Phil, Alternatives to Mainstream Psychology. Well, to wrap up today's show, we're going to be turning to our movie moles, Jan Hocken, once again, and Denise Morris. They're going to be talking about a new film called Hope Springs. It stars Tommy Lee Jones and Meryl Streep as a aging, middle-aged couple who embark upon couples counseling to address issues in their relationship.
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, Hope Springs was actually released last year in August 2012, so it's making the rounds and available for anyone who wants to see it, if after they hear what we have to say they want to. We're hoping so. Kay and Arnold are played by Meryl Streep and Tommy Lee Jones. They are a couple living in the Midwest, and they've been together for 31 years. And the marriage has so declined that they, as we meet them, are sleeping in separate rooms. And that leaves Kay lonely and feeling desperate for intimacy and affection from her husband. Kay makes the first move after finding a self-help book by Dr. Feld, who's played by Steve Carell. Kay pays for the two of them, her and her husband, Arnold, to go to travel to Great Hope Springs, Maine, and participate in Dr. Feld's intensive week-long marriage counseling session. Arnold very reluctantly agrees to go, and the couple undertakes the challenge of reigniting their passion. Hope Springs was written by screenwriter Vanessa Taylor. Taylor also wrote the HBO series Tell Me You Love Me. The series focused on three couples in therapy trying to work through their sex and relationship issues. The series was well received, but only managed one season. Senior actress Jane Alexander played the therapist, notably while working through relationship issues in her own marriage. Sex was not one of them, and I, as someone who saw that series, found that to be an interesting twist in the whole series, and unfortunately, I think this subject was a bit too taboo for folks at the time. And Jan, we have not actually reviewed a mainstream Hollywood film in a long time, you and I, and Hope Springs does give us a lot to dig into. So starting, Jan, with some of your thoughts, you brought this to me as a possibility, and you, as a therapist, have a lot to say about not just, you know, the therapy portion of this, but how does Hollywood sort of represent this? What are the conventions? And what's unique about the film as well?
Well, usually we start with the progressive themes in the films we discuss, and we have kind of a format of how they touch on real human concerns, even though they offer fantasy or ideological solutions to those films or resolutions. But in this case, I think it'd be good to start some with the ideological loading of these kinds of Hollywood films about therapy, and specifically perhaps couples therapy, that lead many of us to not be interested in them or see them as kind of both not interesting and also directing people very much toward kind of individual solutions, getting in touch with yourself or one other person to emancipate yourself from unhappiness. And but here we have some I think subtle kind of subtle treatment of the topic that could be readily overlooked. I think as context, it is important to recognize what's also conservative about this whole kind of subgenre of couples in crisis. I mean, it does affirm marriage and the couple as the primary social bond, marriage as the most important of social rituals, the way in which we can somehow deliver ourselves from existential or social suffering by intimacy with another person, and kind of accepts a kind of psychologically naive notion of that, that you can kind of merge and know someone so deeply that, that's what life's about, is pair bonding, that Freud would call regression to the fantasy of merger with the mother that we have to grow up and get over. But having said all that, and it does, you know, kind of carry those kinds of problems, there's quite a bit that's interesting going on here. For one thing, it departs from many of these films by offering no revelation of a family secret or a trauma to explain this kind of wearing away of affection and a chronic kind of unhappiness that prevails. And so you don't, there's no real drama to it. And it's a kind of closely watched encounter through the therapy of the defenses people build up over time. And it's, even though she's oppressed by him, he exhibits a lot of the kind of emotional abuse of a traditional patriarch in intimidating her and projecting onto her his own insecurities and anxiety, always blaming her or someone else for his own vulnerability or anxiety. Nonetheless, she kind of comes through as a person in her own right, not just someone, a doormat to him, but someone who has tremendous strength and brings quite a bit to this, both in ways that she affects the dynamic, the unhappy dynamic, but also kind of over time tries to emancipate herself from it in ways, I think, in some alignment with a kind of a feminist perspective.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that definitely comes through the reviews is that folks have felt like the script is good but not spectacular, but the performances really do give that nuance, and there's a discomfort at times watching both of them work through this stuff, which I think helps kind of fill out the narrative. None of this is easy. None of this is at all comfortable. And then as a younger viewer myself, I suppose, in my late 40s, though, I'm made uncomfortable by things that I sort of take for granted about sexuality and about what I'm comfortable talking about. And that way, I think it really did well to present a topic that, you know, I sort of thought of it this way. You know, they are in their 60s, both the actress and actor and the characters. And they weren't sort of, they weren't necessarily missed by the sexual revolution, but it didn't necessarily stop in their town either. They're both kind of struggling with, as you said, this idea that that therapy is supposed to help us remember that we can know someone so deeply, I think you said. And it seems like what strikes me about what sort of has happened with them is that their inability to resolve their issues sexually when as a younger couple is now coming back to fully haunt them in a way, because there's a trail. And we learned that Arnold actually has a sexual appetite and desires for certain things, and Kay has struggled with meeting that and with having her own liberated sexuality, and that's not an unusual dynamic to struggle with.
Right, and I think what the Dr. Feld character in this couples therapy setting does well, that actually reflects what good couples therapy should do, is that he's kind of an alliance with both of them, but also recognizing women are more apt to, in patriarchal societies, register and express unhappiness with how things are going, and men are more apt to, not completely true, but there's a tendency or pattern to say, no, things are fine. Mm-hmm. And so he keeps working away at Arnold's resistance, but he also explores Kay's resistance to sexuality, but you could say that this is a kind of anti-feminist treatment, because she, even though he is really emotionally insulting and hostile to her, she's able to kind of recognize that he's struggling with his own insecurity and vulnerability. And so to say, you know, this is women, she should just leave him halfway through the film. Right. Just leave him. Yeah. Get over with it. This guy is like not going to change. He's in his late. He has no interest in changing.
Yeah, he doesn't want to spend any money.
He doesn't want to spend any money.
There are any cold cuts in the Econo Lodge.
Doesn't even want to go to a nice motel. I mean, there's nothing here to work with.
Yeah.
But it's like the good wife. There is a kind of 50s script of the good wife knows how to read her man, and she picks up on something in him. And over the film, you say, well, there is something there. Uh-huh. There is, and that she needs to teach him to read her sexually or respond. But then you could say, well, why is so much of this work always to women? But what, how it departs from that kind of 50s treatment where women know how to make men a good partner is that the therapist hones in on him and says, your wife is very unhappy and you need to do something about it. He said, wait, you're making her unhappy. He said, no, your wife is very unhappy and you need to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And so it does fall back on, he kind of confronts him with this kind of patriarchal mode of relating. But maybe we should talk about just a few high points.
Yeah, yeah.
And favorite scenes from Hope Springs. There is one scene you particularly liked about her going into the self-help section of her local bookstore.
Right. Well, they're in Hope Springs, our Great Hope Springs, and they've been given a series of exercises, and they, in the spectacular failure of doing them, they often find themselves in different parts of the town, not a very big town. But she goes in specifically to buy a book that's titled something like Sex Tips for Straight Women from Gay Men. And it's really, for me, less about the fact that that book exists or that she's going to get that book, but her whole handling. And this, again, is like, you know, classic Meryl Streep, who could say 1,000 things in the way that she had.
That moment of awkward embarrassment.
Yeah, and then just like, she's going to pay cash for it because there will be no trail.
You know? It's like for her hard porn material.
Yeah, and never the willingness to do it, the willingness to go in there and get that book is just, yeah, it's fantastic.
And it is, you know, you have the sense that it's about oral sex.
Yes.
And that often what makes people uncomfortable, straight people, about gay men particularly, is they have to think about other ways of having sex. And there's this sort of repression, mm-hmm. you know, kind of pushing out of mind that there are a lot of ways of doing it, and they have mm-hmm. not experimented that in that area. There's also a wonderful scene where they seem to have failed at their therapeutic tasks, their homework assignments, and so they're both discouraged. It's a moment of crisis in the film. They go home, and he hears her masturbating in the next room, and it evokes quite a bit about she has to kind of not only get in touch with her own desires, but she has not really explored her own kind of sexual feelings on her own terms, and that becomes a kind of subtle moment in the drama.
Yeah, and for him to also acknowledge that she's doing it and has done it, and maybe not for a long time, but is ready to do it again.
Yeah.
And it, well, I think it really reminded me of another one I'm going to put a plug in for, Scenes from a Marriage. Ingmar Bergman's film covers some of the same territory in the 70s. Unlike this one, they get a divorce, and apparently the divorce rate doubled in Sweden that year. So I don't know which is the better outcome.
Right, exactly. Well, this is Denise Morris and Jan Hocken for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We've been talking about Hope Springs.
Well, that's it for our show today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. All of the segments that you heard today, as well as the whole show, can be found on KBOO's website and our subpage on it at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to our guests, to Bill Resnick and Bill Smaldone for talking about the national global security state, to Jan and Mike for following up on the hunger strikes down in California, protesting solitary confinement and torture in America, to Jan and Denise just now for reviewing Hope Springs, and for Dave for coming on to talk with me, hopefully not for the last time, about Star Trek and its progressive and otherwise thought-provoking themes. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Visegrad Group PDX Festival, November 9th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. To celebrate the 95th anniversary of independence of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian nations, this one-day festival will share traditions, history, arts, and crafts, and national food of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian communities within Multnomah County. Again, the Visegrad Group PDX Festival will take place at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue, on Saturday, November 9th, from 1 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, November 4th, 2020.